I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you between sessions of Valheim here in the mountains of Utah. Only a tiny bit of admin this week. I'm taking off the holiday season to schedule recordings, play more Valheim, and do some writing in my real job. So, enjoy your holidays, and we'll see you in 2023 with more episodes. Now, on with the show. My guest this week is comedy writer and podcaster Sean Baby Riley. Sean Baby is an old-school Cracked alumni known for his work with fellow PageBreak guest Robert Brockway on 1900hotdog.com and its podcast, Dog Zone 9000. Sean Baby is also written and performed for Attack the Show, Adult Swim, Crack.com, and numerous internet venues. Sean Baby and I chat about the strange things he researches, trying to get the tone of a joke across in text, and the balance between creating and reviewing. We discuss good and bad faith in online discourse, as well as the need to punch down, and the lines that Sean Baby makes for himself when creating comedy around real people. We generally solve all the world's problems, so enjoy my conversation with Sean Baby. So I thought it was pretty funny that somebody on Twitter asked me to discuss with you the strangest things that we have found in our research. And I feel like it's a very silly thing for me to bring up, because like I Wikipedia some things once in a while,
right?
And you research strange stuff for a living.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because I generally, like, the madness has started before I've even done the secondary research. Like, I'm like, this is the weirdest book I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, I uncover more strangeness. Recently I did one. We were doing anime week on the website on 1900 Hot Dog, and I do not enjoy anime. And so I was kind of trying to find a way to circumvent having to watch any cartoons. And so I found these how to draw a sexy anime girl books. And I'm like, this seems strange enough. I could make fun of these. And then I found that there was some copy on the back of the book that was like, these sexy babes are perfect for you and your child to draw together. Drawing is so wonderful for a child to learn. And I'm like, what the fuck are they talking about? And so I looked up the author, which is just standard operating procedure for me. Found several other books about drawing sexy anime girls with not the exact same copy, but a slight variation of that copy of how great it is to draw with your kids, but also name dropping the topic. So it wasn't just boilerplate that they stuck on a whole bunch of books they were making. They kept rewriting how great it is to draw these naked titties with the children. And I'm like, this is so strange. And so I dug deeper and deeper and found that this person had all these pseudonyms, and they were just self-publishing just like garbage, just churning out self-published nonsense with very tiny variations of the same copy on the back of every book, no matter what they were drawing. And then I found that they did a whole bunch of knockoff like Star Wars books and Barbie books and whatever. And so I found just this empire of trash being done by either one person or a group of people using the same copy about how wonderful it is to interact with your children using these just either illegal or lewd or profane or terrible things. And so I'm like, that's maybe a good example of the kinds of things I find once I start digging in.
Yeah.
But yeah, Brockway makes fun of me. God, I'll give you another quick example. I was looking up this old game called Versus, and no one remembers it. It was a real garbage game for like PS1. The strategy guide was completely insane. And so I'm going through the strategy guide. Very poorly produced and laid out. So it's kind of funny in that way that it's just sort of a failure in every direction. The person who designed these characters, their claim to fame was they were like a artist for Marvel Comics. And so I looked this person up, and when they said artist for Marvel Comics, like a truly mean-spirited reply might be, what did you do, like, were you a letterer for Ultra Force? And that's like literally what they were. They lived like two issues of Ultra Force as the letterer. And I'm like, I feel like if you're at a cocktail party and, you know, you're hanging out with Jim Lee and you're like, oh, hi, Jim Lee. I'm also a comic writer or comic artist. And he's like, oh, cool. What'd you work on? And you said I was a letterer for Ultra Force. You're like, okay, I'm not sure we're peers. But I started looking him up and he's like kind of a sweet older dude teaching martial arts to kids. And I was like, oh, like sometimes you hit those dead ends where you're like, I think I like this person and I don't want to make fun of him.
Yeah.
So that happens occasionally in my line of work, but not often.
I was actually really curious about whether you guys kind of, when you're trying to develop these new things, new stuff to talk about for the podcast or to write about on the website, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I was really curious whether you have like a line where you kind of say, okay, we're now punching down. Oh. Let's back off of this. Or do you?
Absolutely.
Is that something you think about a lot?
All the time. I think about it, at least 200 times more now than I did in like the year 2000. Like when I was first getting started, I was a mean spirit. I guess we all were in the year 2000. That's just how we interacted with the world. But but now I definitely think like, who could this hurt? Do they deserve this? Generally, I love when I find someone who made something that's crazy, but also turns out to be a piece of shit. And it's like, oh, I can just go crazy on them. Because, you know, I guess I met so many people over the years doing things. I would meet people who I wrote about. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, people are like, hey, you reviewed our game. You really made fun of us, but it's hilarious. We like hung it up in the office or whatever. And like, that's a nice feeling. But I could tell I pissed some people off. Like I've gotten hate mail from people who I wrote about where they're like trying to start a beef or whatever.
Yeah.
And usually that's kind of fun in its own way. But for the most part, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. That being said, if someone puts garbage out into the world, I don't mind them knowing it's garbage and knowing that they're getting dunked on somewhere.
Right. Well, and that's a really interesting kind of line that I think all creators and, you know, people that create and consume media, you know, they kind of have to try to figure that out at some point in their career, because you've got that kind of thing where on the one hand, it's, you know, everybody who's putting something out there, they kind of implicitly accept that possibility of quasi-celebrity status, right?
Sure.
But also, for me, for instance, I don't want to badmouth some author that I might meet at a convention next week and exactly. Maybe they turn out to be super nice.
Yeah, there's definitely that. Like, the possibility of running into someone and like realizing, oh, you're a real person and like you probably hate me for what I did. I think that's fair. I guess when I met Uwe, I have a Uwe Boll saga. I don't know if you know about, but like he was supposed to fight these like nerds that made fun of his movies. He's like real sensitive about the movies he makes, but he's also really untalented.
Yeah.
So he was scheduled to beat up these kids. And I used to host this show on G4 called Attack of the Show, which again, it's on TV again. So I guess you could go and watch it. He wanted to come on that show and fight the host. And the host is like, that's crazy. But you know who would do it is our co-host, Sean. And so I was like, hell yes, I'm down. Whenever it's scheduled, I'm ready. And then he's like, how big are you? Do you know how to fight? And then it turns out like I'm much bigger than he was expecting and I kind of know how to fight. And so he's like, And the way the story got spun is that he's sort of like a coward, but I think he just didn't want to like film Rocky IV. Like he just wanted to like bully some nerd. And he's like, I don't want to like, you know, go toe to toe with some guy that can punch me in the face. So, but anyway, I went to the premiere of Postal, which was around that era. And, I saw him there and I was like, I got to go up and like give him the opportunity to kick my ass. Like I didn't want to go up to fuck with him. I was just like, hey, I wrote that thing about you. He's like, yes, I know who you are. But he like didn't like want to fight me. He just wanted to explain how like all my jokes weren't like true science. I'm like, well, yeah, they're jokes. Like he just literally does not have a sense of humor. So That's our interaction. But that was the only time in my life where I'm like, the person I'm going to go talk to might want to fight me. Cause it was like, I don't know. I wrote a lot about him after he backed out of the fight, very much calling him out for being a coward or whatever. And most people knew I was kidding, but to this day, I'm sure that haunts him.
Well, and I mean, that's like the ever present problem with social media, right? Is nobody ever really knows how serious or how much somebody else is kidding or how much they're just, you know, they're playing or being facetious or whatever. Like there's no ability to read another person through the internet.
True. And once you start interfacing with the world, like thinking in terms of how offended people are. Like, that's virtually, I mean, your sense of humor has committed suicide, I guess is how I could put that. So you lose your ability to tell when someone's kidding. I've had people find some of my earlier work and say, like, I don't know if this guy's kidding or what. And then they'll, like, say a line from the article that's just so objectively a joke. Whether you think it's funny or not, it's like, obviously that guy's kidding. But they're approaching that with this lens of, like, oh, but it's kind of sexist, or it's kind of, like, ableist, or whatever it was. And once you're, like, trying to identify that, you're not trying to identify, like, the tone or the joke.
Yeah.
And so there's that problem, too, I guess.
Right.
And I don't want to turn it. This cancel culture, Brian, this cancel culture.
Right. And I don't particularly want to talk about cancel culture because everyone else talks about it.
Not good people, though. Not guys like you and me.
But, like, it is like a, it's this, like, whether or not it's, you know, like, a severe problem, quote unquote, like, it is a thing that exists and it's a thing everybody talks about. And, like, and somebody like you who's producing content on like, sometimes a daily basis, mm-hmm. I imagine that kind of thing, you've got to have somewhere in your head where you say, okay, I am very forward about the fact that I do comedy. I'm always trying to joke around about this stuff. I'm never trying to punch down. I've just got to say funny things and hope people just let them slide.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't want to hurt people. I tend to, like, genuinely in my heart, not have, like, racist and sexist tendencies. You know, whatever. Every now and then during soul searching, I realize, like, oh, I do have some prejudices in there, whatever. But, like, for the most part, I could make whatever joke I want and count on the audience understanding it. Like we all did back in the 2000s, I would use the word gay for something that didn't have anything to do with what someone did with their love life. But it was, you know, and yet I did have gay fans who maybe in spite of that or whatever, didn't get too offended by it. You know what I mean? And I don't want to say, like, it was okay for me to do it. I wouldn't do it today. But at the time, I think people understood, like, this is just how, whatever, this type of douchebag talks. He doesn't mean this in a hateful way. And I think if you look at it now, like, if you showed it to, like, a 16-year-old kid now, said, hey, read this jokes from the year 2000, they'd say, oh, this is just hate speech. Like, because they don't understand, like, this is not really the perspective we had at the time.
Yeah.
Because at the time, no one thought, like, hey, this guy's writing hate speech. It was very, very much like, God, I don't know, Dennis Leary, I guess, is a good cultural touchstone of how, like, it was sort of understood that you could be an asshole in a kind of ironic way. And we don't really mean these terrible things we're saying. It's just...
Well, and with certain words, like, you have certain words that end up being just filler words that mean a very particular thing in, like, a cultural context. Mm-hmm. And then that cultural context changes in a very short amount of time. And it's such a weird thing to look back on, like you said, like,
yes,
using the word gay at, you know, early 2000s.
Sure.
Very much. I mean, I was in high school at the time, and that was just, that's how everybody spoke.
Completely normal. Right. And no, it wouldn't have even occurred to anyone to say, like, oh, hey, you're being homophobic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a way, I suppose we all were, but on such a, I don't know, innocuous way versus someone who, like, legitimately might say, you don't have a right to live if you're not this. But I suppose, like I've used the word insane a couple times already today. I feel like maybe in 10 years, people will look back on that and, like, oh, you shouldn't call stuff insane just because it's, like, silly and different. You know what I mean? Like, we're always trying to find new ways to be better people, I guess. So I don't want to, that's why I don't like these discussions of cancel culture, just because, like, at the end of the day, we're all just trying to be better. Let's go, people, we're all growing up. We can still hate each other. We can still make fun of each other. But, like, you don't want to get people outside your target involved in that. Like, if someone is being crazy, we should be able to pinpoint words to describe this person as crazy without, like, throwing everybody in with them that has mental problems or whatever.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not the guy to draw these lines.
Right. And the lines are, like, I mean, the lines are ever shifting. And I think that giving people mostly the benefit of the doubt with casual things, casual conversation, especially, I feel like a lot of us, it's such a hard thing to talk about because there's part of you that wants to say, I know it when I see it. Because we've all been having a conversation with like a new neighbor or something like that. And then they suddenly like throw out a word or a phrase or something. And the way that their tone is, you can just immediately, something in your brain goes, oh, this person's a bit racist.
Yep.
and it's so different, but it then someone saying maybe the exact same thing, but with a totally different tone, you know, in like a joking atmosphere. And it's, oh man, it's so hard to explain though.
Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with the respect you have for someone's judgment. Like I work with Robert Brockway and he's got very, very good judgment. So when he makes an offensive joke, I could almost always give him the benefit of the doubt that he means it, you know, in a certain way. I'm more of the offensive joke guy than he is these days. He's way more on top of it than me. Like, if you want to talk about somebody who day to day, like, thinks about stuff like this, like, he's the one who's usually like, we obviously can't run this. You're a fucking maniac. But he's our voice of reason. If you could believe that, if you read his work, that's going to be terrifying. But for the most part, if someone says to me like, hey, you're like being careless with your words here, you're being, you know, sexist, racist, whatever, I generally am like, I get a little pissed off because I'm like, it's obvious to me that I'm not. And I'm like, you got to, you know, you want to have respect for someone's opinion. If this hurt their feelings, fine. But if they're like telling me like objectively, this means this, I'm like, no. You missed at least a couple of twists or turns in this joke here.
And objectivity is like, it's one of those things with, I don't know, with language and with the internet and all of that, the ridiculousness of like information exchange now. Objectivity like doesn't even exist, right?
Correct. Yeah. Anyone can play enough games with words that anything can mean anything. And as soon as you draw the line and you say, okay, we do not use this word anymore, basically you made it very funny for someone who's clever to like use that word in a way where they can get away with it. And then you've sort of made it really enticing for someone who is a piece of shit to use that word. And then use that cool guy that I just mentioned as like his example. Oh, it's okay if the cool guy says it, but not me. Or when, you know, you obviously get what I'm saying. But once you start like making objective facts about what you're allowed to say and not allowed to say, you're just making tomorrow really obnoxious for you when you have to deal with the assholes using that in bad faith.
Oh, and the bad faith, it's always going to come out.
Yeah. And I feel like we probably waste more time on that than anything. Like, I don't know how, I don't want to turn this into like a politics thing, but like if someone identifies with a Republican, like, I just don't even know why you fucking bother talking to them. You're like, they don't mean anything. Like, it's just, and maybe they did 40 years ago, but just like the current era, if someone's speaking about right-wing talking points, like nothing they say means anything. It's garbage. And the idea that we can go online and have these silly debates or the centrist idea, they're like, oh, let's listen to some of their ideas. It's like, no, if you still think these people are making sense, like maybe your brain's broken. I don't know. Did I solve everything? Did I solve politics? I think we did it.
Yeah. No, that's covered. I think we're good. Man, this is just, as long as everyone hears this, we'll be fine. The world's solved.
I just feel like a great example is that they're sort of forgiving college debt in a very small, inadequate way, but whatever. An objective public good. And then, of course, the Republicans are like, hey, no, you can't do that thing that's good for everybody. And you're like, well, why? And then they start asking these questions like, well, how is this fair to the people that pay for college, whatever? And it's like, you dumb fucking asshole. You asked that question 30 years ago. We answered it then. Someone, look under the replies to your own tweet. 17 people just answered it in the last minute. And it's just like, they keep just asking the same questions over and over as if like, hey, I ended it with a question mark, so I must be smart, right? I must be seeking knowledge. But it's like, all of these things have answers. And there's just half the people who decide they can forget that and keep asking the same questions. Like, how come we got monkeys if we came from monkeys? You know, like, has anyone ever answered that? I'm just going to keep asking it.
It's this amazing kind of ability to find an audience who doesn't like to do even the slightest bit of critical thinking.
Right.
And then kind of just hammer on those particular people.
Sure. And just keep trying to make it look like the world's simple for them. Like, no, it's super easy. They'll tell you it's hate speech because it is, but there's just two genders. And then like, yeah, that's true. Because that makes sense to me. That's easy for me.
Yeah.
And as long as I'm not any of the weird letters, then I'm one of the good ones. And that's super easy for me because I'm not one of those non-default things.
Something that always gets me kind of, you know, doing that weird, you know, distant pondering thing is this idea that every bit of our cultural norms, every tiny aspect of the way we live our lives, there was some point in history at which a few people got together and said, yeah, let's do it that way.
Right.
And I mean, like with Christianity, like you can literally point to the conferences that they held and said, you know, let's do it this way. You know, but like all parts of our culture, that's just, and when you start breaking it down like that, that these were just normal people who decided, yeah, maybe it's simpler or it's more convenient or it makes me richer, you know, like,
right.
It's so easy to start breaking down all of these, like, oh, why do we care that we do it this way?
Yeah. And those are questions that are, that usually have answers, and we can find them. And then become smarter. And some people do that, and that's great.
Yeah.
And some people very deliberately do not. And that's very frustrating for me.
There's a lot of money in making everybody feel like yesterday was better.
Mm-hmm.
And that they've got to keep X value in place.
Right. Yeah.
Just
the heart of fascism. We solved another one.
Right. We're doing this. Great. What's next?
Hey, Page Break listeners. Brian here, rudely interrupting myself for a bit of a plug. Making a podcast isn't free, and I'm hoping that you enjoy it enough to pitch in a pittance. To do so, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak, where you can toss as little as $3 a month into the tip jar, $5 a month to get the podcast ad-free and early, and $10 a month to hear your name in the credits and feel a smug sense of superiority. You can also buy my books from your favorite retailer or direct from my website. Thanks to everyone who contributes. Now back to me.
You made a video game.
I did. It's called Calculords.
I thought this was very funny when I found this.
Yeah, it's massively complicated. It's quite a departure if someone only knows me for my dick jokes, but it's kind of a math game where you're using your math as your resources to play cards. Otherwise, it's sort of a traditional collectible card game. The gameplay is sort of like a tower defense. There's these three lanes. The bad guy puts guys in three lanes. You put your guys, and everybody has all these abilities. It's very complicated. But it was kind of like a dream idea that almost certainly would never get made unless I personally made it. Because I pitched it to a couple companies, and they're like, yeah, I don't have any idea what I'm looking at, pal. I'm like, okay.
So where does this game come from? Like, you know, because you can trace your career as somebody who has worked in comedy and lots of kind of like reviews and, you know, sure, all sure. of this stuff that kind of everybody knows you for now. So where does the left turn into suddenly making a math video game?
Well, I guess I do like system designs, just unrelated to the comedy stuff. I do I played Magic the Gathering for a little bit back in the day. I really like poking at stuff and seeing what's broken, which I guess is sort of the things I write about in my comedy. But like when I'm playing a game, I really like to find like overpowered combos and things like that. Like it's very satisfying to sort of break a system that way. And so I just sort of daydream while I play games, while I do other stuff. And I design all these little systems. And Calculords was a combination of several systems that I thought were interesting. Like, I guess I was also trying to pragmatically solve a problem that sort of bogs down all of collectible card games. I don't know. Do you play games like that?
I have in the past. I don't anymore right now.
So you're familiar with like mana or this type of thing. So like in Magic, you first turn, you have one mana, second turn, you probably have two mana, so forth. So it takes a long time to ramp up. And every game has this building component that I would get really impatient with in a lot of games. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And so the math was trying to solve that so that if I could add a skill element to your available resources. And so if you're good at the math, you will have a higher amount of resources than someone who's bad at the math. Just trying to add a skill cap to all of these little systems, which I thought was missing from so many games like Magic the Gathering. Obviously someone can be better than someone else at Magic the Gathering, but not buy a ton. Once you get the basics, like you're ready to like hang with the grand champion, they'll beat you with some subtle maneuvers. But I was like, what if there's nothing subtle about it? What if like a good player was just so much better than a bad player, even just the mana part? And so that's sort of how that came to be. Me trying to solve a problem of Magic being boring by making a math game.
Yeah. and how did it do?
Critically, it did really well. I'm terrible at marketing. It was poorly monetized because of my, what do you call them, ethics? So like, so even if you were an addict, and a lot of people became very addicted to the game, you can only give me like $11 total. And so it wasn't like a regular card game where you're kind of counting on your hardcore addicts to give you hundreds of dollars. So obviously it could have been a very big financial success if I marketed it and monetized it in a better way, but it did, it made some money. It's, you know, no one's going to retire from it.
I think I saw something somewhere that said that there's a second one.
Yes. I did design a second one and we kickstarted it, but we didn't reach the Kickstarter goal and the project kind of fizzled out from lack of funding. But I adapted that actually into a third version, which is so much better. So I'm sort of glad that that project didn't finish. I have no idea when I'll finish. My favorite part of designing games is like the first month where it's just a billion ideas and you haven't done like all the hard work yet.
Yeah.
And so I have 11 or 12 just sweet game ideas that are, you know, in the spreadsheet stage, maybe the paper prototype stage, but like, you know.
I mean, that's way further along than I've ever gotten with my game ideas.
You have some game ideas?
I mean, my game ideas have always ended with, man, this thing in this particular game I'm playing right now could be so much better if it did X.
Yeah, that's a great start.
And what if I made my own game like this? And then that's about as far as it gets.
Oh, see, that's the magic part. That's where you're like, you're imagining just the perfect game. Then you start to sit down and design it. And you're like, oh, no, I don't know how they did this part. Or like, oh, this is not going to work at all. And that's when the real work comes of trying to, you know, solve all these little problems. Not to mention the real work of balance and art. And
I've got the skills to do that for like a fantasy novel.
Sure.
Don't have the skills to do that for a game.
Yeah, it's, I bet you do. I bet it's just the will. Like if you took a year off and designed a game, I bet you could design a very nice game. Oh,
yeah, I mean, a year off. Yeah, that.
That'll happen.
Right, that'll happen.
You know how writers take a year off?
Yeah. I mean,
does your skin crawl? Like if you haven't written in 2 or 3 days, does your like skin crawl off your bones?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
I did this thing early in my career where I kind of came out the door. I was doing pretty well. And I would take 6 months off every time I finished a book. And, you know, when you're an epic fantasy reader, that's a writer, that's still only once a year or year and a half or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you take 4 to 6 months off and I would just play video games. I'd tinker in the garden, just bullshit like that. And and I realized a couple of books back that it was making me absolutely miserable. Like,
yep.
Like that time that I thought that I loved and was living for wasn't actually fun to me. And that it was only when I was writing consistently that I was actually happy.
Yeah. Finishing something is so great.
It is.
You do novels and complicated fantasy novels. So like you don't get that feeling often. I still do articles. We're still making that dying business model work. And man, I just get that feeling every 2 days. I'm like, oh, I just finished something. Oh. So
honestly, this podcast is part of me going, I'd like a hit of that a little more often.
You're welcome anytime. If you find something silly and want to write on 1-900-HOT-DOG, we'd love to have you.
Oh man. I
get that hot dog rush.
I actually wanted to talk to you about a problem that I have that I know that you don't because of the content you put out. I have this thing where when ideas pop into my head, I don't write them down and I don't remember them later.
Oh.
Like unless it's something like magnificent for a book I'm working on at the time, then I'll try to make an effort. But like, mm-hmm. you know, if it's 1 o'clock in the morning, like, cause I have genuinely had these thoughts over the last year or two, because I've been listening to your podcast and really enjoying it.
Thanks.
And I've had these thoughts of, oh man, I should pitch this to Robert. I could do, you know, a page or two on this topic. And then the morning comes, I have no idea what it was.
Oh, yeah, I hate losing stuff like that. I try to, my notes app is just filled with stuff. Sometimes it's meaningless later, but like for the most part, I hate losing ideas. Like like when I'm sitting down to write, I love to just like let my mind go all over the neural map. The cyber kids call it surfing the neural map. I maybe they don't, but I love to just let, like I'm writing a joke, like, this thing, I need to call this person ugly. And then I think, should I call them ugly? Is that ableist? Like we were discussing earlier. And then I've decided, no, fuck this guy. I'm going to call him ugly. And then I get to think like all the things that are ugly and all the things that suck. And my brain's going everywhere. And then someone will like interrupt me with a text, or like someone will come into my office and be like, ah! And I, my heart breaks every time. I'm like, oh, I was like, oh, I had this joke. Like, so that feeling of loss that you're describing of like an idea, then not being able to remember that idea. Oh, I hate that so much. And so that's kind of why I write at night. So I'm just like, no one can mess with me for like 6 or 7 hours straight. And I get to keep everything I think of. I throw it away later, of course, because I am a writer. But, you know, at least it was there. At least I typed it once.
Do you ever find yourself kind of overwhelmed with the sheer amount of things that you have to look at to be able to comb out those little kind of gold nuggets that you can put out on your website or on Twitter or whatever?
I wouldn't say overwhelmed. I mean, I have my notes and my partial articles are, it's pretty immense. But for the most part, I have a system where I decide at least a week out what I'm going to write about. And then I hopefully can take a day or two just thinking about different angles to take on it. And then, of course, if it sucks, I have some little padding that I can, you know, start something new. But I wouldn't say overwhelmed. I'm pretty good at focusing on just one or two projects at a time. If it's more than that, I basically don't get anything done. So I understand like the danger of getting overwhelmed. And it's just like, I don't know, something I've trained myself to avoid.
How do you, something I find really interesting is kind of the construction of comedy, because comedy is created it's created in a different way than what I do for a living, you know, which is kind of these, you know, big sweeping narratives. I'm really fascinated by the construction of comedy, because there's a lot of moving parts to it,
right?
Because you have to kind of have a general idea of what your audience is expecting and what they're interested in. And you have to kind of meet that in the middle, but you also have to craft jokes that aren't just straight up jokes,
right?
But things that you're talking about, you know, relevance, like you and Robert, for instance, you latch on to kind of pop culture phenomenon, mm-hmm. and you kind of construct pretty much your whole kind of like online persona around the comedy that you can mine out of that. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've developed very consciously, or is that something that kind of came about just over the course of working for 10 years?
I think that's tough to answer. I think I've always liked the pop culture stuff as a base, just because we all share it. There's also something about like finding a movie no one's heard of and showing it to them has a element of like, hey, look at this fun thing I found and discovered and sharing with you. But also it's a shared experience, and that, like, you know what a movie is, you know what like a bad movie is. And so we have this point of reference that we can go from. And that I think is just a really good starting point. And then I can say like, here's what a movie should look like. Here's what this movie looks like. And now that's inherently strange. And then I don't know. I'm self-taught when it comes to comedy. So I'm not sure I know how to articulate how to make something funny, but I have been a comedy scientist for 20 years. Like Brock, we did this a lot too. It cracked. We'd get these articles in and have to make them funny, which is just a very functional process of like, we need to keep exactly what they're saying, but just like punch it up. You know, something every comedy writer has to do, but it's so there is a science to it. That's hard to articulate, but you know, I'm not even sure I'm answering your question anymore. I think I'm just rambling about the fluid nature of hilarity.
No, I actually find this kind of stuff really fascinating. I don't follow a ton of American comics, but I'm huge into British stand-up. Mm-hmm. And so I listen to a lot of their podcasts. I watch a lot of shows that those guys are involved with. And I'm always really interested when one of them is kind of dissecting what they do for a living. Mm-hmm. And for instance, you know, and somebody says, oh, what's your day like? To me, I can easily say, oh, well, generally, you know, I try to write 2,000 or 3,000 words, do a little editing, answer emails, whatever. But a comedian, like I think this was Frankie Boyle, I want to say, said that he tries to write like at least one joke a day.
Okay.
And that's such a fantastically interesting thing to me, because to me, a joke is it's so much more nebulous than saying, oh, I've got to write, you know, 2,000 words. Mm-hmm. Because a joke could be anything for a stand-up comedian. It could be anything from, you know, 5 seconds to 5 minutes of material.
Right.
I find that stuff so interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, you've got to establish a premise. You've got to come up with a punchline. And it's obviously not 2,000 words. Like when I finish a 2,000-word article, generally there's 70 jokes in that, some 70 things that I would call a joke.
Yeah.
Like I think I write with a lot of joke density. That's sort of my shtick. Whether that's obnoxious to people or not, I don't care, but that's just the way it is. And so one joke a day, it sounds funny, but also like it's just completely different. A stand-up joke versus like what I smash into an article.
Something I find really interesting about kind of your background is that you kind of, you seem to have been like your time period of becoming a public figure, becoming a comedian, you know, kind of working and growing an audience pretty closely mirrors the time at which the internet became a place for pop culture and a place for the world to kind of share all this weird stuff.
Right.
Do you think that that's fairly formative to kind of who you became?
Or the other way around, maybe I caused the internet.
I hadn't thought of that. I'm going to have to rethink everything. Can we take this back up later?
It might, for better or worse, it might be all my fault. I don't know.
Oh, man. Well.
Yeah, I would. It's possible. I never really like interfaced with the internet. Like I'd get the emails and I'd sometimes read them. I would try to read them all, but I wasn't very good about replying to them because I found myself too focused in on the hate mail, and I'd want to like you know, make fun of them or get in fights with them, and that would be very intellectually inspiring but not artistically inspiring. So it, like if I get a hate mail, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna do an article on how big a dumbass this guy is, and then that would like eat my brain, and then at the end of the day it's just like, yeah, but I'm like targeting in on one douchebag who like isn't worth the attention. And and for the most part, especially back then, attention was sort of what the internet was for. Like, I don't feel like people are as starved for it now as they were then. They obviously still are, but like back then, people just wanted to exist. And so they'd send a hate mail just hoping you would put their name on the internet and make fun of them. And that would just be like, look, I did a thing. I'm not nothing. And so there was like, you're kind of giving them what they want when you elevate them to someone worthy of responding to. I sound like an asshole, but like, maybe you know what I'm talking about.
No, I absolutely know what you're talking about. It's a validation of somebody who is not attacking you to be, you know, like to be a critic, but to just be critical.
Yeah, right.
Or because there's a difference between those two things. Very big difference.
Sure. And I guess you'd call them reply guys now. They're still out there. They're trying to mooch off other people's energy and get some attention for themselves. But yeah, I guess I was not so much an internet user as a producer. I, of course, used it a lot. But all of the things that people went to back in the day, I wasn't like a big like, oh, sure, I went to Strong Bad all the time. Like, I, of course, did sometimes. But it's not like I got together and discussed internet stuff with my friends. And so I don't think the internet formed me so much as I formed it, I guess is my point. I was obviously joking, but maybe not.
It's funny because I also didn't feel like I was like an artifact of the internet. I kind of came to being online like later than a lot of people my age. And I didn't find the, oh, let's go be, let's go be edgy in some chat room. I didn't find that interesting at all.
Right.
And so funny enough, one of the reasons I was so delighted when I first met Robert was because one of the very few formative things for me from the internet was kind of the golden age of Cracked.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I've met quite a few people my age who kind of feel the exact same way. Mm-hmm. And then it's funny to kind of meet guys like you and Robert. Like to be like, oh, you guys produced a lot of the stuff that I laughed at when I was in college.
It's, yeah. If you went on the internet between like 2000 and 2015, either me or Robert wrote it. Like, it's just chances are that's who was responsible. Yeah, he wrote so much at Cracked. I mean, I did too, but like that, Robert touched so much it went through Cracked. It's funny when we get together, especially with Jason Pargin, like we just kind of know everything. And I don't mean that like an egotistical way. It's just like we have all the knowledge of Cracked just sort of in our brains, which was so much of everything. Like everything people know on the internet eventually trickles down into a Cracked list in between, you know, 2006 and 2012. And like all that just kind of stuck to our brains because we had to edit those articles. And yeah, I don't know. I guess so. We are products of the internet in that way, in that all those lists.
I something that I find really interesting about what you guys do is that I think most people kind of dismiss this or don't think about it. More likely is that to be able to kind of intelligently dissect and make fun of, you know, pop culture things, mm-hmm. you actually have to understand how a story is creative, how characters are rounded out, how, you know, narrative is carried over arcs.
Right.
You have to understand a lot about storytelling. You have to understand a lot about, you know, culture, about even about things like politics and world history and things like that. And sure. there's a lot more kind of there's a lot more multifaceted stuff that goes into producing what you guys produce than I think most people think about.
Yeah, that's probably something you only notice when someone gets it really wrong. But like recently, one of the either Logan Paul or Jake Paul, one of those Paul dudes, he did some movie review of Jordan Peele's new movie, Nope. And he just had such a fundamental misunderstanding of like of what artistically the movie was saying and like what narratively it was saying. Like he just is such a doofus that his review basically betrayed how he didn't understand a fucking thing that movie was saying. And so everyone's making fun of him for that. And so you can tell when someone's not doing that. And so basically if we're doing our jobs right, then we're making fun of a movie and you never at any point think like, I don't think this guy knows how character development works. You know what I mean? Like if someone says that, then you fucked up. But yeah, of course you have to know, what a filmmaker's trying to do. And the joke can be that they failed doing that, but the joke should not be like, look, he like a David Lynch movie. You can't make fun of a David Lynch movie for being weird. He's obviously trying to be weird. And so you need to be able to understand art at a pretty high level if you're gonna properly make fun of it. Even if you're gonna reduce me to just the guy who makes fun of stuff, like at the very least, you have to know how everything works.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So I was actually really curious whether you obsess or even think about the pop culture your daughter consumes or will consume as somebody who literally dissects pop culture for a living.
Yeah, a lot, actually. I, 'cause she's five, and when she was a tiny baby, she watched like baby YouTube. And now that she's five, she watches like streamer YouTube. And I find that to be like just awful, just substanceless garbage. There's a couple she watches where I'm like, okay, these guys are kind of doing their own thing. But for the most part, it's so formulaic in really hacky ways. And so I do try to get her to watch, you know, something more interesting. Like we like Teen Titans Go. It's a good kids program. And what's nice about that is there's a lot of depth to their like references. And so like they did an episode where they turbo teened And so then I show her Turbotine, and now she's sort of understanding like the layers that she's going to grow up in. Like everything at this point being made is 7 or 8 lasagnas of previous generations pop culture. And so she's getting a real good, like, I think metacognition for stuff like that. And when she sees something, how she knows that it means what they're saying, but it is also referencing something else. And that could also have a second meaning. And so I just feel like she'll be so much sharper than me and my friends when it comes to like analyzing media. And so I think that's nice. I think that, and she's taking to it instantly. And I don't know. She's my only kid. I don't know how gifted she is relative to other children. Plus we're in the pandemic, so I don't see any other children because they're filthy. But it seems like she's getting it. It seems like that there's so much media to watch that it's easy to pick good stuff. You know what I mean? Like it's hard to put all these thoughts together. But growing up, we were very country. So we had like 2 channels that worked. And so when we were left to the TV, it's like, this is shit. We were watching like black and white 50 sitcoms. And, you know, that was a treat if that was on. Sometimes it's just golf and you're just like, I guess I'll watch golf because I hate everything. And now it's like you go to YouTube and you can just literally watch anything. I'll tell her like, close your eyes and imagine something and then we'll search for it. And so I feel like that's another thing that kids are going to get that will greatly benefit their brains relative to ours, and that they can seek out whatever they want. And they're very much rewarded for having a good imagination. Like if she thinks of something interesting, we get crazy fun videos versus me, where we had like channel 2 and 3. And that was like my imagination when it came time to watch TV. So
do you find yourself dreading the moment that she starts picking things herself, kind of without any input or oversight from you? Or do you think that that will be a kind of really interesting development in kind of her character?
I mean, I already kind of let her do it. I will cut her off if she's picked something shitty, but for the most part, she exhibits good taste. And it's very telling about the personality she's developing, what she finds interesting. I like that. But
that's cool.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned you grew up kind of very rural. So I mm-hmm. saw you had gone to the University of Idaho. Did you grow up in Idaho?
No, I grew up in Oregon, but okay. I ended up getting a scholarship to U of I for engineering. There's like Oregon and Idaho do a lot of like student trading. So I can't remember the undergraduate program, but yeah, so that's why I ended up at U of I.
I did not grow up in the West, but I live in Utah now. I'm very familiar with kind of Mormon culture. Like, how was that kind of Idaho small town college experience?
Oh, I think I was just talking about this the other day, because Idaho is like a right wing shithole. Like there are Nazi towns. Like Coeur d'Alene had a Nazi march every summer. And which is not too far out of Moscow, but Moscow was like a college town. And so it was pretty diverse. And, you know, it was a bunch of young people trying to be better. And so it was a little pocket that exists in Idaho. I imagine all college towns are like this in right wing states. But, so it had a pretty big city vibe, because that's what we were trying for as a people, I suppose. Like we all wanted to be cooler than we were. We knew we were in Idaho. And I don't know. I don't know if that's a good answer, but like when I say I grew up country, I was like 12 miles up the mountain from a town with 10,000 people in it. And so, and they were like, my folks were preppers. They were a bit deranged. And so, raising animals and that kind of country stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely run into a lot of those in Utah still.
I'm sure.
And I mean, I grew up in Ohio and we kind of vaguely knew people that were like that, you know, an hour outside of Cleveland.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you find them all over the place, but I think Mountain West does kind of attract that type of person.
For sure. Yeah. There's a lot of towns in Idaho that seem to be made up entirely of preppers. Like I can't remember the name of the town. There's Twin Falls. So I think it's the one that Bruce Willis bought for a while. And then there's a town near there that's just sort of like this trendy place where rich preppers go to like build a bunker. It's just, okay, why not?
It's such a weird, like when you have the rich preppers versus like the kind of the hillbillies that have been there for, you know, 80 generations.
Yeah, it's sort of the difference between a hobbyist and like someone who's functional, like whose brain is in a place where like, yes, I want to overthrow the government. I want aliens to come. Like they're living in their imagination versus someone who's like, it's kind of fun. Because I think there's a lot of appeal to prepping if like you're kind of shitty at stuff. Like if you can't make good wine, like, that's fine because you'll need wine in the apocalypse. This is for the apocalypse. This is fine. For the apocalypse, all of these canned goods I'm making are just fine. You wouldn't eat them, but like if you had to, you wouldn't die, right? Like, I feel like that's the appeal. That seemed to be for my parents too, because they weren't too good at canning or reloading bullets or whatever. But like, it's fine for the apocalypse.
Yeah. I mean, it'll keep you alive.
Yeah.
Maybe if you don't get botulism.
There's that. My stepdad used to make this stuff. It was like lard in rice. And he was like really proud of the amount of calories that were in it. He's like, yo, man, there's so much calories in this. I'm like, yeah, but no one would eat this. And it doesn't matter. He's dead now. It, like, no one ever ate it. We threw it out after he died. But whatever. Everyone wastes a lot. Everyone burns a lot of time with their hobbies. This was his.
Oh, man. But that is true, though. Everybody wastes time and energy and money on the dumb shit that they do in their spare time.
I mentioned Magic the Gathering earlier. I probably put $800 when I was a freshman in college into Magic the Gathering and then quit playing it. I'm like, well, that's a lot of money for an 18-year-old kid.
That's a huge amount of money for an 18-year-old kid.
And I sold it, got a PlayStation 1. So
moved on from there.
Yes.
Yeah, I was into Magic when I was in sixth grade, I think. So I would have been about 12.
Okay.
And
I didn't like Magic enough that I would have played with a 12-year-old. You do see those. You'd see those adults at the mall playing with like strange kids they didn't know. Those guys liked Magic too much.
Yeah. I'm always really interested in those hobbies that people get into, like Magic, where like a huge part of the premise is figuring your stuff out and then going and playing against strangers. And like strangers are the last people I want to play games with.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the wall I ran into. It's like, I love designing a deck. And then I had a few friends that liked to play, but not enough that, you know, we all stuck together and had a Magic club or anything. So once they stopped playing, I'm like, I don't have anyone to play with. Or I'd have friends that played, but like weren't very good. And so I would just stomp them and they were like, well, this is no fun for me. I'm like, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, I tried to be casual about it. This would have been 7 or 8 years ago. And I just found that you can't be casual because the friends that will want you to be a casual player with them are so much better than you and have everything planned out so well that you just get smashed every time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to find that sweet spot of like someone at your level of enthusiasm and skill and free time and scheduling.
Now you have done a ton of different medias. Like I think you're probably best known, I would guess, for articles.
Sure.
But you've done podcasts, you've done work in front of camera.
Uh-huh.
Where is your comfortable spot?
Oh, articles is like, that's the dream job. I've written, you know, screenplays and, fiction, whatever, a lot of game writing, but, yeah, kind of, I would imagine it's safe to say I work in every media, and that's, something about an article. I love that, you can set something up quickly. Like we were talking earlier, how you have to establish the premise before you get to the punchline. With an article, like the premise is just built into it. Like, this is an article about this. And like, we're already halfway done. I don't have to build like an act structure. I don't have to build like motivation for characters. I don't have to write stage directions and like dialogue. So it's just like, I can just smash in jokes. After several hours, I've got 1,000, 2,000 words. And yeah, it's done. And it like has a beginning, middle, and end. And yeah. I tell this to everybody. I was just, I was over at Ty Frank's house. We were hanging out, talking, writing, and he writes.
I just talked to him like 3 days ago for this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. He loves to talk writing and he's a brilliant writer. And I'm just like, dude, an article, you come up with an idea. And if you really want, you could be done with that whole project in a night. And it's just the best feeling. And, I don't know why no one else does it. Like, there's just no one who does it left. Even Cracked is just kind of like pictographs and regurgitatings of old articles. And so me and Brockway are like this rules, right? Why are we the only people that know about this? I think it's just hard to monetize maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd imagine the monetization is the difficulty there. You know, it's because clearly there's an audience for it. Like, you guys have a great audience.
Yeah.
But
I think so.
But yeah, it's,
I don't know about great. You're fine.
I'm part of that audience, and I think I'm pretty great.
You're one of the good ones.
Most of those others, though.
No, our our patrons are they're good. We actually have really good fans. Like at this point in my career, I've had so many toxic fans and so many moments where I'm like, God, I just fucking like the cracked fans were kind of there's like a certain class of them. I sound like an asshole again. There's some of them like really smart and like experienced the material in a really high level, right? Like they knew what you were trying to say. They added their own research elements or details and appreciated the jokes. And then there was people that were like, they would have like a weird expectation from the title and then come in and like, you know, say something racist. You know, it's just like those were bad people. And there was so many people that read Cracked that like there was just a certain percentage of them that were that shitty type of person. And so that was a tough era to interface with fans. But like, as it is now, like for the most part, everyone on the Discord is really funny. Everyone on the site's pretty funny. It's very strange. I think when I was doing ShawnBaby.com, I would get so many emails from weirdos. I also really hated people when I was younger. I'm not quite as annoyed by them now, but like back then I was just like, I didn't want to be bothered. And so that also didn't help, I suppose. So anyway, I do very much appreciate feedback from readers. And even when it's bad, I'm trying to gather all these words together. The nice thing about Cracked is that you got feedback from so many people that even when it was bad feedback, you could kind of use that as percentile of how bad an article was. So if you get like a 6% hate mail an article, you're like, okay, that article was a piece of shit. And then if it was much higher than that, generally it was because you said something political or you said something about women or whatever. And then like, you know, the Nazis came out and had something, the review bomb in your article, whatever the fuck they're doing. So from a sheer number standpoint, you can take that input, and that's very valuable as a writer to understand what's working and what's not working. And you need to have that. I should warn anyone if anyone's like listening to this, getting, oh, look, I gotta get that fucking Sean Baby writing advice. But like once your numbers get high enough, like you can statistically tell how good you're doing from your input, but that doesn't work until it gets high enough. Like if only four people write to you and three of them say, hey, you're great, and one of them says you suck, like that's useless. That's statistically, that's all outsider data. You can't use any of it. So I guess that's my hot tip. Be popular enough that lots of people comment on you, and then you can tell if you're good or not.
Right. I'm sure that will work for most of the audience.
You can cut off this. I'm just fucking lost. I lost my train of thought at least 10 minutes ago.
That's all right. This is random. Okay. I'm going to ask you this because I have never heard it covered despite listening to your podcast and reading lots of your articles, and I'm sure that I missed it somewhere. Where does Sean Baby come from?
Oh, there was a girl in college. She was from Korea, hadn't been in America too long, and she really liked me. And whenever I came into the room, she would scream Sean Baby, and that just stuck. And it was so enthusiastic and silly that like I had no problem with it. And so I was like, yeah, this is nice. If you guys keep calling me that, it's fine. And so it really was just a nickname I didn't give myself that I've always liked it. I say that it's fun because it's hard to say with any venom. And so people try it all the time. They're like, oh, Sean Baby. But it sounds like they're like, it sounds cute. Like that sounds like they're, you know, playing around.
Yeah.
So I do like that.
Yeah, I like that. That's funny that you kept something kind of because that transition between, you know, like a regular life and kind of online life is often very weird and awkward for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true.
But the fact that you kept something that transitioned like that is really funny.
Yeah, I try to stay genuine. For the most part, I write, it's highly edited. Like I'll write sort of conversationally and then I'll like make it smarter and funnier through, you know, second thoughts and third passes and all that. But for the most part, if you're reading something I wrote, I would stand by as like, that's the type of person I am in real life. Like, I don't think I'm doing a character, I guess is my point.
That's actually, that's one of those, I didn't even think about the idea that you guys kind of, you and Robert and a lot of the other kind of Cracked writers that kind of came out of that era. I guess I kind of always assumed that there was a bit of caricature to everything you did, like a little bit of playing up parts of yourself, playing up comedy here and there.
I think that's safe to say, yeah.
But you don't consider that playing a character?
I don't think so. I think once I'm saying something that I in real life would probably disagree with, like think that's a character. Like, yeah, I think maybe it's simple as that, but maybe it's another one of those, you know it when you see it.
Yeah.
Like if you showed me something I wrote and I'm like, yeah, I don't agree with that at all. Then I might say, oh, I was doing a character. That's where I was doing the character. But it's probably just because it's old and I was a dickhead.
I mean, weren't we all?
Yeah. I also think there's enough depth to people, and that if I do write something that I don't disagree with at a different time, it's like, you know, give me a couple of days, I might agree with it again. People are complicated.
I always tell my wife that, like, she can't demand new answers from new information from me, because you always have to give me like 2 or 3 days to think about something before I am able to, like, as something as simple as like planning meals next week, give me a couple of days. And like, so when you take really complex ideas about politics and philosophy and religion and all of that stuff, like, you gotta let that shit percolate.
Yeah, you gotta.
And if you don't, if you like have rapid fire answers to everything, I don't trust you.
Yeah, I feel like that too much of the internet, I guess you'd call them content creators, I think live in that world where like, oh, a thing happened, let's say a thing about it. And it's like, it doesn't seem like everyone's thought this through yet. Maybe you need to wait. And so part of the nice thing about what me and Brockway are doing is like, we're kind of creating stuff outside of that, like, whatever you call it, hemisphere.
Yeah.
And so
that kind of cycle of kind of immediacy.
Yes. It's really nice. And Cracked was, I would say a bad combination of that. So there's a lot of stuff on Cracked that we would write that's, you know, evergreen, funny stuff versus like, a thing happened, we got to get an article up. We joke about that a lot on our work Slack. Like, Jason Pargin will come in and say like, oh, hey, do you guys have your review ready for House of the Dragons yet? And like, it's just kind of our internal joke that like, oh, thank, how nice is it that we fucking don't have to care about the stupid dragon show or the Johnny Depp trial or whatever. Like, I don't need to have 6,000 words on Johnny Depp. No fucking Trump article in the can.
Right. And I don't want to have an opinion on everything.
Yeah. It's really nice not having to have an opinion on everything.
It's exhausting.
And almost always wrong. And if you're the type of person who doesn't like to admit you're wrong, then you're just going to make yourself dumber and dumber and dumber until you elected Donald Trump president. Like that's like how it happened. Like people had this immediacy, they had to throw out their opinion and then they couldn't admit their opinion was wrong, which meant they had to have a new opinion about how that old opinion kind of made sense if you think about it. Right. And it's just dumbness, layers of dumbness all the way down.
I had a realization probably around, I was around 26, 27, and maybe this was probably a very formative moment for me, but the realization was that if I am the smartest person in the room, I don't want to be there because I'm not talking to anybody interesting.
Yeah.
I'm like if I feel like the most intelligent person there, then I'm in the wrong place. It's just, I'm not bettering myself. I'm not hearing about somebody's interesting theory that's above my head, but maybe I can grasp it kind of thing.
See, I might be the opposite. I like being in a room and being like, oh, all these people are fucking stupid. Cause then you can get like a wet t-shirt contest going. Like you can like do some, you're hanging out with stupid people. That's a lot more fun. I don't know. That's the way I look at it.
I do love that kind of gung-ho kind of attitude though, because I never had that when I was younger. I was always very shy, very timid about everything. I always was super jealous of the people who were able to kind of walk in and read a room and, you know, get something going or, you know, kind of know who they wanted to talk to immediately, that kind of stuff.
I don't know if I have that ability, but I can get something going. If you really want to have a wet t-shirt contest going, like we can make that happen. Got to find some real dummies though. That's the key. You're in the wrong rooms. You keep finding rooms full of smart people.
Right.
Get the hose out. They're like, oh, I certainly do not want to be here for whatever that hose is for.
And smart people always have British accents.
Yes, that's true.
It tips them off. Well, I have kept you for quite a long time, but I like to end each episode by asking every guest, what's the last thing that you ate that blew your mind?
Whew. I just moved to Portland about half a year ago, and we are kind of going down the list of hipster stuff in our area. We're in Southeast Portland, which I think is the hipster food capital of the world. God, what did we get? I got some like bone broth ramen just today, like 5 minutes before I got on here. That was so nuts. It was like Japanese Korean fusion ramen place. And I was like, this is nuts. I'm not a food critic, so I can't describe it to you. But it was that like thick, like milky bone broth with like smoked pulled pork in it.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. How about you? Same question.
So same question for me. Honestly, so about 6 months ago, I got really into mangoes.
Sure.
And because I had never eaten a fresh mango before, and I randomly got fresh mango, and I loved it. So good. And my wife was like, oh,
luckily you're in Utah, the mango capital of the world.
Right. Exactly. I just go outside and pick them. But I, yeah, so I like, but then like there was like a 3 month stretch where I could not pick a good mango. Every mango I brought home, it would either rot before it got sweet or I would cut it open way too early. I could not figure out the secret from it. And, I was at the store yesterday, grabbed a couple of mangoes, cut them up for lunch right before this podcast, and they were both dynamite.
Fantastic. You know, do you eat like just regular mango or do you eat it Mexican style?
What's Mexican style?
You do like some cayenne, some lemon juice, some salt. I think that'll fix your mango problem because you can have like a mango that's not ready to eat. You do it Mexican style as delicious mango.
Well, I'm definitely keeping that in mind for next time.
Okay.
Because that sounds great.
Yeah. Hot mango tip.
Oh, I love it. That was comedy writer Sean Baby. Thanks again to Sean Baby for coming on to chat. You can find Sean Baby's social media and website down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website or swag from my Redbubble store. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. If you're listening to this via Patreon, please stick around for bonus chat during the epilogue. Special thanks to Elijah, Ivor Gullickson, James Clark, Jennifer Johnson, Jason Nall, Kyle Anderson, Sexton Hardcastle, Talon, Brian, and Will Lebelski for their backing on Patreon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.